In my last lecture, I discussed the virtue of justice and pride and productiveness. I pointed out that justice is the one specifically social virtue of the objectivist ethics, the virtue that pertains specifically to man's relationship with other men. I stated that self-interest is the only proper base and motive of human action, and that in their dealings with one another, men must neither grant sacrifices nor demand them. Among men who observe the principle of justice, men who do not grant sacrifices and who do not demand them, men who do not seek the unearned, there is no clash of interests. Such men deal with one another by voluntary consent, and only when they perceive that it is to their mutual benefit to do so. This is the only possible basis of social harmony and authentic goodwill among men. If men do attempt to gain the unearned and the undeserved, why then of course there are clashes of interest among them. In the sense, you might say, that there is a clash of interest between a hold-up man and his victim. If men try to live by something other than reason and the mind, if they consider destruction a practical and valid means to gain their ends, if they hold their desires outside the context of reality and justice, if they feel free to place the I wish above the it is, and to act on their irrational wishes, then nothing but clashes of interest can exist among men. Neither harmony nor goodwill is possible in a society of cannibals. There is a very important formulation or statement in Galt's speech that I want to quote in this connection. Quote, "The symbol of all relationships among rational men, the moral symbol of respect for human beings, is the trader. We who live by values, not by loot, are traders both in matter and in spirit. A trader is a man who earns what he gets and does not give or take the undeserved. A trader does not ask to be paid for his failures, nor does he ask to be loved for his flaws. A trader does not squander his body as fodder or his soul as alms. Just as he does not give his work except in trade for material values, so he does not give the values of his spirit, his love, his friendship, his esteem, except in payment and in trade for human virtues, in payment for his own selfish pleasure, which he receives from men he can respect." Unquote. If you want to understand how the concept of the trader principle applies to the spirit, and if you want to understand what is its alternative, and if you want to know whether or not that alternative is desirable, ask yourself whether you would wish to be loved selflessly. Ask yourself whether you wish to be loved by someone who gains nothing from loving you, who will tell you that he loves you not for your virtues, but for your weaknesses, that his motive is not admiration, but pity, that he wants to marry you only because he knows you need him, that he loves you not for any selfish pleasure he finds in your character, but only out of a sense of charity and duty. If your self-esteem recoils in revulsion at such a concept of love, question the motives and the psychology of those who advocate it as a moral ideal. Two people who do advocate it are Lillian Reardon and James Taggart in Atlas Shrugged. You will remember the scene where Lillian explains to Reardon her idea of what one should offer in love. I quote, quote, "If you tell a beautiful woman that she is beautiful, what have you given her? It's no more than a fact, and it has cost you nothing. But if you tell an ugly woman that she is beautiful, you offer her the great homage of corrupting the concept of beauty. To love a woman for her virtues is meaningless. She's earned it. It's a payment, not a gift. But to love her for her vices is a real gift, unearned and undeserved. To love her for her vices is to defile all virtue for her sake. And that is a real tribute of love, because you sacrifice your conscience, your reason, your integrity, and your invaluable self-esteem. What's love, darling, if it's not self-sacrifice? Close quote. Or remember the scene between Cheryl and James Taggart when Cheryl is coming to realize the kind of monster she has married. She asks Jim, "Jim, what is it that you want to be loved for?" And he cries, "What a cheap shopkeeper's attitude, to be loved for. So you think that love is a matter of mathematics, of exchange, of weighing and measuring like a pound of butter on a grocery counter? I don't want to be loved for anything. I want to be loved for myself, not for anything I do or have or say or think. For myself, not for my body or mind or words or works or actions." Cheryl asks him, "But then, what is yourself?" And he answers, "If you loved me, you wouldn't ask it. You wouldn't ask. You'd know. You'd feel it. Why do you always try to tag and label everything? Can't you rise above those petty materialistic definitions? Don't you ever feel, just feel?" Close quote. Perhaps you will think that James Taggart states his position too extremely, and that no one in real life believes such things. So I shall now refer you to the writings of Dr. Eric Fromm, a prominent contemporary psychologist. In his book entitled The Art of Loving, Dr. Fromm declares that, quote, "love is the only sane and satisfactory answer to the problem of human existence," unquote. But Dr. Fromm contends it is very difficult to achieve love in a capitalistic society because, quote, "the principle underlying capitalistic society and the principle of love are incompatible," close quote. The principle of capitalism is that of what Fromm himself terms fairness ethics. That's a quote from Fromm. The principle of fairness ethics, of trade, of the exchange of values. Individuals deal with one another only on the premise of mutual self-interest. They engage only in those transactions from which they expect a profit or reward. But to approach love with any concern for one's self-interest is, says Fromm, to negate the very essence of love. To love an individual is to feel care and responsibility for him. It is not to appraise his character as a commodity from which one expects pleasure. To love ideally is to love unconditionally. It is to love a human being not for the fact of what he is, but for the fact that he is. It is to love without reference to values or standards or judgment. Again quoting, "In essence, all human beings are identical. We are all part of one. We are one. This being so, it should not make any difference whom we love." Close quote. It should not make any difference whether the person we love is a being of stature or a total non-entity, a genius or a fool, a hero or a scoundrel. Consistent with this view of love, since, again quoting, quote, "in essence all human beings are identical," unquote, Fromm concedes a certain logic to the idea of marriages arranged between partners who have not chosen nor perhaps even met each other. It is only the, quote, "paradoxical character of human nature and of erotic love," unquote, that makes him feel that such marriages are inadvisable because, he explains, quote, "erotic love requires certain specific, highly individual elements which exist between some people but not between all." Close quote. Paradoxical, isn't it? The desire to be loved unconditionally, the desire to be loved with no concern for his objective personal worth, is one of man's deepest longings, Fromm insists. Whereas to be loved on the basis of merit, quote, "because one deserves it," unquote, invokes doubt and uncertainty, since merit has to be struggled for and since such love can be withdrawn should the merit cease to exist, quote. Furthermore, deserved love easily leaves a bitter feeling that one is not loved for oneself, that one is loved only because one pleases, unquote. It is the capitalistic culture that inculcates such concepts as the deserved and the undeserved, the earned and the unearned, and thus poisons the growth of proper love. Quote, love is an act of faith, unquote. Proper love should raise no questions about the virtue or character of its objects. It should desire no joy from such virtue as the object might possess. For if it does, it is not proper love, it is only capitalistic selfishness. Ladies and gentlemen, to love is to value. And the immorality of the concept of love advocated by Lillian Reardon, by James Taggart, and by Dr. Fromm is that it seeks to divorce love from values, and worse, to oppose love and values. The proper answer to this concept of love is given by John Galt when he states, quote, a morality that professes the belief that the values of the spirit are more precious than matter, a morality that teaches you to scorn a whore who gives her body indiscriminately to all men, this same morality demands that you surrender your soul to promiscuous love for all comers, unquote. If any of you feel that the principle of justice is too cruel to be applied to love, you now know what is its alternative. I leave the choice to your self-esteem. Make no mistake about it. There are people who want unearned love, only they do not often state it as explicitly as Lillian Reardon or James Taggart. They do not want it identified that the love they get is unearned. They do not want to be told, I love you out of charity, even though you don't deserve it. No, they want someone to fake and to pretend that they do deserve it. For instance, if a woman tricks a man into marrying her, refuses to give him a divorce, and holds him through appeals to his sense of duty, she will not be content if he declares that every day he spends with her is an act of misery and self-sacrifice. She will keep pleading with him to admit that he is really happy, that things are really for the best. She will want him to fake a feeling he does not possess. Similarly, if a mother demands sacrifices from her children, she will not want her children to identify them as sacrifices. She will want her children to fake reality and to pretend that they are selfishly happy in obeying her. Now, you may ask, are there no circumstances under which it is proper to help other human beings? To help, to offer help to other human beings, spiritually or materially, is a perfectly valid and proper human activity, provided neither you nor they regard it as your moral duty, provided it is not a sacrifice on your part. It can be perfectly reasonable to offer moral support or financial assistance to a human being who has achieved values of character you can respect, or who is fighting in a cause of which you approve, or who is putting up an honest struggle against adversity, or who is the victim of an injustice. To help other human beings when it can be done without self-sacrifice is a perfectly normal and healthy expression of human benevolence. And I wrote on this subject some years ago in the Objectivist newsletter in an article entitled Benevolence versus Altruism, in which I distinguish between healthy, rational benevolence and goodwill toward other human beings and the immoral creed of altruism, which specifically demands self-sacrifice. I think you would also find it very valuable and rewarding to read an article of Miss Rand's, which originally appeared in the Objectivist newsletter and was subsequently included in her collection of essays entitled The Virtue of Selfishness, The essay to which I refer is entitled The Ethics of Emergencies, which deals specifically with the circumstances under which help to others can be proper. I want to state, however, before moving on, that this whole question of help to others is really a minor issue. It is not the heart and essence of the science of ethics. Too many people, on first hearing about the objectivist ethics, start, in effect, by asking us what is our attitude toward giving quarters to beggars and helping village idiots. This is the last, not the first, issue of morality. It is not for the sake of dealing with beggars and village idiots that man needs a code of values. If life on earth is the standard, it is much more important to know what objectivism has to say about ability than about incompetence, about intelligence rather than stupidity, about achievement rather than helplessness, about life rather than death. The view of existence contained in the altruist ethics is that disaster, calamity, and destruction are the normal and inevitable conditions of human life. Suffering, pain, and death swallow up the altruist view of life. He does not ask, how should man achieve happiness? He asks, how should man minimize suffering? He does not ask, how should man achieve life? He asks, how should man face death? The morality of altruism holds not life, but death as its standard of value. It holds as its cardinal virtues faith, which is the destruction of the mind, self-sacrifice, which is the destruction of values, humility, which is the destruction of certainty and self-confidence. Objectivism, in contradistinction, holds reason, purpose, and self-esteem as its highest moral good. Ask yourself by simply contrasting these three alternatives, reason or faith, purpose or self-sacrifice, self-esteem or humility, which code leads to man's survival and which to his extinction? Does man survive by using his mind or by rejecting it? Does he survive by achieving values or by renouncing them? Does his survival require the confidence that he is worthy and able to live, or does it require that he suffer chronic anxiety and self-doubt? This last, I should mention, is what the virtue of humility actually means. The concept of self-sacrifice is the heart of the altruist morality, the motor that translates its abstract values into concrete, specific actions. Altruism preaches that man must live for the sake of others, that he must place their interests above his own, that their happiness, not his own, must be the goal of his life, that self-sacrifice is the basic virtue and the standard by which all his actions must be judged. If the goal of an action is his own welfare, it is evil. If the goal is the welfare of others, it is good. If life is the ultimate goal of the objectivist ethics, then life is the standard of value and the good is that which life requires. Good actions consist of achieving, gaining, and keeping values. That is, those things which are required for man's proper survival qua man, by one's own effort and for one's own sake. But if death is the ultimate goal of a morality, then death is the standard of value, and the good is that which leads to death. Good actions consist not of gaining and keeping values, but of renouncing and sacrificing them. The basic rule of a morality of life is achieve. The basic rule of a morality of death is give up. Observe a crucial point. You cannot give up or renounce or sacrifice that which you do not possess or value. If sacrifice is a virtue, you must have something to sacrifice. Altruism does not tell you to abstain from pursuing values. It tells you to pursue values in order to sacrifice them. It tells you to gain values but not to keep them, to achieve them in order to give them up. It does not command you to commit suicide. It commands you to live in order to die. Let us examine the metaphysics of altruism, the view of existence implicitly contained in a morality of death. Since only the concept of life makes the concept of value possible, since the concept of value does not and cannot apply to inanimate objects or to corpses, since nothing is good or bad to a corpse, it would be impossible for man, impossible philosophically, psychologically, intellectually, emotionally, to hold death as his standard of value, death in the actual literal sense of the word, with full conscious awareness of its meaning. Death is not another state of existence different from life. Death is non-existence, the nothing, the blank, the zero. It would be impossible for a living entity to hold its own annihilation as its highest value and to go on living. If any man attempted it in the literal sense of the word, what would happen would be the total collapse of his consciousness. He would not be able to act, to think, or to feel anything, which means that he would not be able to hold any values whatever. In order to preach a morality of death, its advocates have to use life, in effect, as a stolen concept. They have to smuggle the concept of life into the consciousness of their victims, as well as into their own, or no such morality could become conceivable or communicable. All altruist moralities of any age, tribe, culture, or civilization had to promise man another life in exchange for renouncing the one he possesses. Another life in another dimension of another reality of a different universe, in exchange for renouncing the life, dimension, reality, and universe he knows. Another kind of existence in exchange for the one that exists. Without mysticism, without the rejection of reason, no altruist morality could be or ever has been possible. To preach or accept altruism, men had to step outside reason, reality, and existence. Into the mystic's void. That other reality which the mystic altruists promise man after death is always alleged to be superior to the reality of this earth. But no specific identity or nature is ever ascribed to it, except in terms of negatives. We're told it's not like life on earth, it's not like anything which we would call the good here on earth. It's in effect a negation of just about every concept of existence we possess. In order to enter that higher realm, man has to live his life by a moral code dictated to him from that other world or dimension, by rules and standards belonging to the other world, no matter how much suffering it causes him in this one. In fact, the more he suffers in life, the greater will be his reward after death. Suffering is the price of admission and the currency he has to accumulate on earth in proof of his virtue. This leads us to the question, why are the demands of that other life opposite to the demands of man's life on earth? Why does his happiness in that other reality depend on his suffering on earth? The answer given by all mystic moralists is that this earth is evil by its very nature, evil metaphysically, and therefore a man must make himself worthy of that other reality, which is good, by pursuing its values here on earth, where they do not belong and are not metaphysically applicable. By what standard is the earth to be evaluated as evil? By the standard of that other reality. What is that other reality? It is non-earth. What are its values? The non-values on earth. Now I will remind you of two slogans. One is from the Bible, the meek shall inherit the earth. The other is from the communist hymn, The International. Who had been nothing shall be all. This will give you a clue to the motive, purpose, meaning, and origin of the altruist morality, and an inkling of who is to be sacrificed to whom. Remember that the concept value does not mean only material values, it also means spiritual values, intellectual values. Now translate the mystic's abstraction into its concrete, specific meaning. If the values of that other reality are the non-values on earth, then the morally, intellectually, and spiritually inferior men here on this in this world are to be the superior men in that other dimension. The men of self-esteem, the virtuous, the intelligent, the able, the strong, the brave, the creative, the independent, the happy. All those who are successful at the task of living on earth, they are to be damned for it and punished in that other reality. While the contemptible men, the vicious, the stupid, the incompetent, the weak, the cowardly, the parasitical, the dependent, the suffering, all those who fail at the task of living on earth are to be blessed for it and rewarded in that other reality. It is not the unearned in matter that the mystics and altruists are after, but the unearned in spirit. It is not love for the so-called little people that moves them, but hatred for the men of greatness. And it is not kindness or help for suffering that they seek. If it were, they would not damn those who are able to provide it. Any projection of any imaginary other dimension in metaphysical opposition to the reality of this earth has only one philosophical and psychological meaning: hatred and rejection of the actual nature of existence, hatred of man, of reason, of reality, a longing for a universe where A is non-A, a universe without identity, without causality, without the necessity of effort, mind, or thought. As proof, the Garden of Eden, heaven, paradise, nirvana, and all the projections of the mystic's ideal ever offered, all of which have as their basic common denominator the vision of an effortless existence, a vision of man as a happy automaton who is automatically provided with the satisfaction of all of his needs, wishes, or whims, relieved of the burden of a mind, and in the case of nirvana, relieved even of the burden of existence. You have often heard it said that a mystical belief in another life after death serves as a consolation for men in their sorrows. The advocates of this viewpoint would claim that since suffering does exist on earth, there is no harm if helpless, unhappy men find consolation in projecting another, happier existence, and that this is the only effect of mysticism on human life, the only purpose of a mystic creed as far as life on earth is concerned. But if this were true, why do the mystics attempt to make their other dimension real here on earth? If their higher realm is the opposite of this one, why do they teach men a morality which is impossible to practice on earth and which leads only to agony? The full philosophical answer is that there are no two or four or six realities, but only one reality, the one in which we live, and there is no escape from it. Whatever metaphysical view men hold of the nature of existence, it is in this reality that they will practice it. There is no other. If men believe that flaws, vices, weaknesses, defects are values, that to fail at the task of living on earth is a value to be rewarded, and that this metaphysically is the good, then it is here on earth that they will demand their rewards. And suffering, not achievement, will be the claim check to values and the hallmark of virtue. What may obscure the profound viciousness of the altruist morality, the extent to which it is anti-man and anti-life on earth, and for that matter, anti-reality. What may obscure the issue and create confusion about the motives of the advocates of altruism in many people's minds is the historical fact that Christianity was born in a period when men had reason to rebel against the evil, the corruption, and the moral depravity of the degenerate culture of the Roman Empire, and that the early Christians are pictured as gentle, benevolent, courageous human beings, which many of them possibly were. The real issue here is not the personal motives of individual men, but the nature of a mystic philosophy, any mystic philosophy, whether men accepted by mistake or by full conscious intention. If one damns the metaphysical nature of man and of this earth in protest against the evils of a specific culture and a specific time, if one renounces reality altogether and takes refuge in the fantasy of another dimension, the results on earth will carry out all the logical implications of that premise, whether any particular mystic intended it or not. That premise grants metaphysical potency, metaphysical rightness to evil on earth. It implies, for instance, that the evils of the Roman Empire were not created by the depraved choices and standards of men, but were necessitated by the very nature of this earth. That metaphysically evil is the right way and the only way to live, and no other way is possible here on earth. Whether any individual mystic intends it or not, any rebel against human evils who escapes into another dimension takes the easy way out and achieves the opposite of his intention, if love of the good were his intention. He surrenders the earth to evil and joins his voice to that of the emperor or the dictator who proclaims that only evil is practical on earth and that the good has no choice. But mistaken idealistic motives are not the major force that maintain the reign of mysticism and altruism in the world. These two philosophical doctrines are much older than the Judaic Christian tradition. They were the ruling philosophy of all pre-Grecian cultures and of all Oriental cultures. The Orient has never known any other view of life. If altruism were merely a mistaken form of rebellion against the evils of mankind's history, against the terrors, cruelties, and injustices of the Roman emperors or of feudal lords or of absolute monarchs, a rebellion motivated purely by compassion for human suffering, it would have vanished in the 19th century. It would have been dropped by all moralists in the face of the Industrial Revolution and of the American form of government, which were the brilliant, eloquent, irrefutable, practical demonstration of the fact that life on earth is not evil, that terror, violence, and rule by brute force are not the right way to live on earth, that men can achieve an incomparable, undreamed-of state of happiness, well-being, prosperity, success, and mutual goodwill, not by sacrifices, but by the rational pursuit of rational values and the practice of rational virtues. If the elimination of suffering were the altruist motive, they would have been the first to cheer the Industrial Revolution, to support a free society, to fight for capitalism. But that is not what happened. What happened was the opposite. It is precisely in the 19th century that the philosophers and moralists of altruism began to create systems for the translation of altruist theories into practice, into a political reality on earth. Socialism, communism, Nazism are the philosophical products of the 19th century. It is the altruists who clamored, as they clamor today, for a return to tyranny, terror, violence, and rule by brute force. It is the altruists who clamored, as they clamor today, for the enslavement of men. It is the altruists who engineered, as they are engineering today, the absolutist totalitarian state. And what is the ideal advocated by all collectivist dictatorships? the Garden of Eden, the other dimension, to be made real here on Earth. The effortless universe of guaranteed automatic survival, of unearned rewards and undeserved virtues. The dream world of impotent mediocrities, which was to be reached only through the grave, which was to fulfill the promise that who had been nothing shall be all, and which they now propose to reach through the grave of those who had been something. Mysticism is not a protest against or a consequence of mankind's evils. It is the basic source of most of mankind's evils. It is not an innocent error, but a monstrous fundamental evasion that would make anyone blind to the metaphysical and moral contradictions of altruism, which in essence may be summarized as follows. Why is the earth evil? Because man suffers on earth. What should he do about it? Suffer more.